Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters the most in life, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. So in this show, I'll bring you the latest research in how you and your child might connect in brave wavelengths when playing and doing activities together. Then I will speak to Jen Taylor, author of Hello, My Name is Warrior Princess, and the podcaster of The Naked Podcast. Be sure to listen to my podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, share it with your friends, write a review, contact me, call me, 818-648-2140, email me at fujianzain@gmail.com. Let me know what are some of the topics that you want us to talk about, and I'll talk to expert, and I'll share with you what I know about that topic. So please contact us and let us know. We'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Hello, this is Dr. Fujian Zain. For all of you who are interested in changing something in your life, or shifting a new career, or bettering your intimate relationship, or, you know, it's just time to take care of you, but you really don't have time to take off from your busy day, or you're just too far away from my Beverly Hills or San Clemente office, I have a great offer for you. I'm only offering this time-limited package to you. For online therapy, if you are living in the state of California, or online coaching wherever you live around the world. Now listen, a 10-week package with a $500 discount. Call me to schedule your appointment, 818-648-2140, 818-648-2140, or go to fujian.com, F-O-O-J-A-N.com, for more information. It's time to take care of you. Because you are worth it.
So here is the tip of the week. I've been noticing this week, due to many painful events that are repeatedly shown either in media or clips that go viral on social media sites, people who are not really part of trauma and the traumatic events are experiencing secondhand trauma. Now, I remember this happened again during 9/11 and many of the school shootings or, natural disasters, when so many people, including children who were not even part of the traumatic event, had full symptoms by watching the footage over and over and over again. And recently, I keep seeing it again as it's happening. So it's important to take care of yourself emotionally. Each person has a different level of tolerance in being stimulated emotionally. You need to know your threshold and respect your body and your psyche. If you experience an emotional overload, please remove yourself from all news, literally. All news, a graphic, visual, auditory intake. You know, if you really want to read it, go ahead and read it. Read it on your phone or read it in a newspaper or on a website versus going through looking at videos or constantly going over the television news media and then looking at the videos. There are times that horrendous events happen to people we know or don't know. But feel very connected to them. If you can act in a way that is helpful to the survivors of the trauma, please do, because your actions will remind all that we are, we're not alone, we're together. If there's nothing you can directly or indirectly do for the survivors or their family, then be compassionate, think and feel love for them. Beyond that, please release your emotions and let go. Ruminating, worrying, what if that happens to you, generalizing, oh, all people are like that, all men are like that, all women are like that, all, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. Gossiping and doing, first, not helping the survivors, and it certainly does not help you. So take care of yourself. You need you being healthy and functional in order to help others. Remember that. If you don't take care of yourself emotionally, you can't function in your life. So your life goes into an actual trauma based on with the trauma that you weren't even part of. So you can't do that to yourself. So take care of yourself. We'll be right back with the latest research.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
KMET Banning.
Welcome back to the Inner Voice. Here's the latest research. Have you ever played with a baby and felt a sense of connection, even though they couldn't yet talk to you? New research suggests that you might quite literally be on the same wavelength, experiencing similar brain activity in the same brain regions. A team of Princeton researchers has conducted the first study of how baby and adult brains interact during natural play, and they found measurable similarities in their neural activity. In other words, a baby and adult brain activity rose and fell together as they shared toys and eye contact. The research was conducted at the Princeton Baby Lab, where university researchers study how babies learn to see, talk, and understand the world. Previous research has shown that adults' brains sync up when they watch movies and listen to stories, but little is known about how this neural synchrony develops in the first years of life. So, an associate research scholar in Princeton Neuroscience Institute and the first author of the paper published December 17th in Psychological Science study, Real Life, face-to-face communication between babies and adults is quite difficult. Most past studies of neural coupling, many of which were conducted in Hassan's lab, involved scanning adults' brain with functional MRI. In separate sessions while the adult lay down and watched movies and listened to stories. But the study of real-time communication, the researchers needed to create a child-friendly method of recording brain activity simultaneously from baby and adult brains, which led to developing a new dual brain neuroimaging system that uses functional near-infrared spectroscopy, which is highly safe and records oxygenation in the blood as a proxy for neural activity. The setup allowed the researchers to record the neural coordination between babies and an adult while they played with toys, snack songs, and read a book. The experiment had two portions. In one, the adult experimenter spent 5 minutes interacting directly with a child, playing with toys, singing in nursery rhymes, or reading Goodnight Moon while the child sat on their parent's lap. In the other, the experimenter turned to the side and told the story to another adult while the child played quietly with their parent. The CAPS collected data from 57 channels of the brain known to be involved in the prediction, language processing, and understanding other people's perspectives. When they looked at the data, the researchers found that during the face-to-face sessions, the baby's brains were synchronized with the adult's brain in several areas known to be involved in high-level understanding of the world, perhaps helping the children decode the overall meaning of the story or analyze the motives of the adult reading to them. When the adult and infant were turned away from each other and engaging with other people, the coupling between them disappeared. That fit with researchers' expectation, but the data also had surprises in store. For example, the strongest coupling occurred in the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in learning, planning, and executive functioning, and was previously thought to be quite underdeveloped during infancy. So the researchers said, we're also surprised to find that the infant brain was often leading the adult by a few seconds, suggesting that babies do not just passively receive input, but may guide adults toward the next thing they're going to focus on, which toy to pick up, which words to say. While communicating, the adult and child seem to form a feedback loop. That is, the adult's brain seemed to predict when the infants would smile. The infant's brains anticipated when the adult would use more baby talk. And both brains track joint eye contact and joint attention to toys. So when a baby and an adult play together, their brain influence each other in dynamic ways. This two-brain approach to neuroscience could open doors to understanding how coupling with caregivers' breakdown is atypical developments such as in children diagnosed with autism, as well as how educators can optimize their teaching approaches to accommodate children's diverse brain. The researchers are continuing to investigate how this neural coupling relates to preschoolers' early language learning. That is so awesome. So I'm also excited to have Jen Taylor with us. Now, we talked about babies. She is a mother of 18 children. That is an accomplishment. She's a published author of a self-help memoir about her life growing up in dysfunction, podcaster of the Naked Podcast for over 2.5 years, close to 3 now, interviewing people about their struggles and the who, what, when, where, how they got to where they got, or they're going there. And she has had a blog for over 8 years about her family, running, minimalism, divorce, blended families, foster care, adoption, and what goes on in raising a large family. She lives in Reno, Nevada, with her kids, an amazing partner, and a dog. So it is, don't go anywhere, because we're going to talk to her about her life, her achievements, all that she can teach us from a life fully lived in all aspects.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, the Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Hello, this is Dr. Fujian Zain. For all of you who are interested in changing something in your life, or shifting a new career, or bettering your intimate relationship, or, you know, it's just time to take care of you, but you really don't have time to take off from your busy day, or you're just too far away from my Beverly Hills or San Clemente office, I have a great offer for you. I'm only offering this time-limited package to you for online therapy if you aren't living in the state of California, or online coaching wherever you live around the world. Now listen, a 10-week package with a $500 discount Call me to schedule your appointment, 818-648-2140, 818-648-2140, or go to Foujan.com, F-O-O-J-A-N.com, for more information. It's time to take care of you, because you are worth it.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Foujan Zain, and I'm so excited to have Jen Taylor with us. She is the author of Hello, My Name is Princess Warrior Princess. So nice to have you, Jen.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
So there's so much that I want to ask you, but it was interesting when I was reading your bio. The first thing was, like you said, a mother of 18. I'm like, no. She just means like she, I don't even know what that means. I should ask her what that means. She probably means that, you know, she is a mother of an 18-year-old. That's probably what she wrote and she didn't. And as I was reading your book, I got it. No. You are a mother of 18 children. Yeah. That, you know, you're officially a master at that.
Well, it wasn't what I was planning on going for as far as expert. There was no mad plan in it. But yes, I am mom of 18. So it was awesome. A pretty exceptional journey.
It is. I'm ongoing.
Yeah, it doesn't really end. You don't stop and being a parent.
Exactly. So first I want to talk about your book, and then from there we can go around and, you know, talk about also your podcast. So what is a warrior princess? What came about for you to name your memoir and going through your life as a warrior princess? How come you came up with that?
It was based off of Wonder Woman, actually. Mm-hmm. When I thought about superheroes, Wonder Woman was the one that stood out to me. You know, as a kid growing up, I was born in 70. So as a kid growing up, we had Wonder Woman on TV, and she was exceptional and beautiful. And someone in high school, because I'm 5'9", someone told me I was an Amazon. And of course, at the time, that was, I was embarrassed, and I was self-conscious because I was taller than most people in high school, even though it's 5'9". It's not like, you know, I'm a woman that's 6'4" or something, but I was still taller than most people. It made me super uncomfortable. And I never even asked. It could have been a compliment, but I was so uncomfortable. I was so self-conscious that I assumed that it was a put down and, you know, walked away, and it kind of stuck with me, and I wanted to slouch. And you think about Wonder Woman, and she's an Amazon, and what better compliment, whether it was a compliment or not. Since then, I learned to really love how tall I was. And I love wearing heels and being over 6 feet tall when I walk into a room. I don't have any intimidation about it. But that was Wonder Woman. When she was becoming a superhero, I don't remember the man's name that was kind of designing her, but he was telling his wife about her, you know, these are all the qualities. And she said, well, if those are all of her qualities, and the biggest one is that she did action with love, then it has to be a woman, not a man. And that was how Wonder Woman was designed. And so I just loved that. She was a warrior princess. And I think all of us are. I'm speaking to women as a woman. I'm not excluding men necessarily, but I felt like it took me a long time to embrace feeling like a warrior princess, and height wasn't the only reason.
I know that as I was reading your book, what I loved about it is not only it's like your also podcast is Naked, the Naked Truth of All About You, but you also brought the pain and the suffering and how it had affected you, but more than anything, what it had taught you at the end that brought that warrior ounce, and how the part of you learn these lessons through hardship. You talk about your parents' divorce when you were six, and that taught you how to protect, how to tell people you care about them, how to know your roots, and don't place blame on others and show love and support. And talk a little bit about, you know, how your experience was in going from a family that had a turmoil, but then they got divorced, but then the turmoil just continued in a whole different way for you.
I think as we're growing up, from the time we're kids, if you can really look back and consider the timeline of your life, you realize that through the whole thing, you're building a toolbox, which, like you said, it's a huge part of what I do on the Naked Podcaster. Also, when I'm interviewing guests, I want to know what toolbox were you building during these struggles. And I recognized fairly early on, as a fairly young kid, that I was actually building skills that I could work with. I think it was the most poignant. There was the divorce, which was hard as a six-year-old. I didn't see a lot of turmoil between my parents. And I've asked my mom later in life, I don't remember fighting and arguing. And she said there really wasn't much. But after that, my father became this raging alcoholic that was one of the meanest people I've ever gotten to know. But on the flip side, in third grade, I had a teacher who took me under her wing just because she was being her. I met her 19 years ago. I re-met her, and she didn't remember me. I didn't stand out to her. She was just doing her job, except with her doing her job was being herself. Mm-hmm. And that was really giving to these kids that she had in her class. So I love that she didn't single me out like this poor kid who was really struggling. She was just being her and being genuine, but she made such a pivotal difference in my life that things got considerably worse after that in my timeline. But I knew it was worth it to her. And I knew as a young kid what that meant. I thought about the fact that even though these horrible things are happening in my home life, in my family life, I'm worth it to someone out there. And that was enough to really keep me going on. And it was also enough at a pretty young age to realize how I treated people made a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you talk about your father's alcoholism and what that taught you with, like, life is short and precious and cherish it, but also tell people you love them. Mm-hmm. Choose balance, which is so important. Many of the children of addicts, they learn the concept of choosing balance. Some of them, they get separated from that and they also fall into an addiction. But at least the idea of, because they see the destruction of not choosing balance, and laugh often. And then you also learned from not only your dad had addiction, then you also learned your mother had the addiction of food and going through unhealthy relationships, which some of that was passed on to your own experience, right?
It was. I don't know how you can grow up in a situation, have nothing impact you. I think I did tremendously well considering. Here's what I knew. I knew that I didn't want my life to look like that, but I didn't know what that meant. And so in that discovery of trying to break those patterns and not perpetuate them, you make new mistakes and different ones. So I wasn't an alcoholic, but that doesn't mean that I didn't make different mistakes. I chose men that I think are really good men who weren't good with me, or I wasn't good with, or that combination created some sort of friction. And friction for me is familiar, and addiction for me is familiar. And so I think I chose people that were much better than the situations that I had grown up in, but that doesn't mean that they were healthy. And it's right. Really, really hard to discern that, especially when you're 17, 19. You know, it's really difficult to discern that. I did go through therapy also. I had a therapist once that said, you have this list of things you know are not okay. And you have this list of things that you want or you know are okay, but there's this enormous gray area in the center, and you just aren't sure which way that falls. And so determining what was acceptable behavior for someone to treat me with and what was not, and navigating that has been very difficult. Mm-hmm. So like you said, it was important for me to feel like I was treating people the way I felt they should be treated. And I wanted to be treated and to be more patient and to watch my words. And that doesn't mean that you're good at it all the time, because I certainly have not been. And with 18 kids, you know, I mean, I'm an expert because I've had a lot more opportunities, a lot more kids, volume, and a lot more opportunities within those kids to fail and make mistakes and try to, you know, right the boat, so to speak. So, yeah, my relationships were probably, I would say at this point at 49 years old, the thing that I struggle with the most as far as if there's anything in my life I regret. And I don't think that's the right word, but if I could do it another way, that it would be that. And again, I chose men that I think are really phenomenal people. Not together we weren't, and not with the tools that I was gathering and using at the time. And certainly they weren't either. So that whole interaction, and it's the only place in my life I feel like there's any amount of failure.
Right. Well, I, agree with you that ultimately the first experiences, at least we have, is kind of duplicating what the role models of our parents have been. Although we know that's not what we want to do, but I think naturally, because you, as you said, it was the familiarity, there's a way that we fall into it. And then when we experience it ourselves, then we go through another type of a hardship and then come out of it and learn other things. But you also talked about the sexual abuse from your stepfather. So I could see that the conversation of who men were, whether it was the addiction or whether it was the abandonment or whether somebody who you thought it was a very loving switched, you know, your father's behavior switched, and then this person who came to your mother's life switched on you guys too. And then I could see where all of those pieces had such a tremendous impact on you, where the boundaries were blurred. And like you said, there was some familiarity which would pull you in, but right beside it, there's also familiarity of the, let's say, the unhealthy parts that are underneath it, that after a while it all shows up. And but this time you had something, you had some, let's say, power into shifting, getting yourself out of it, learning, healing in a whole different way.
Isn't that huge? When there was a point in my life, I remember I graduated at 17 and I was on my own, and it was Christmas, and it was, I felt like it should be sad because it was sad growing up. And then I realized I have no depressed attachment to the holidays. And so it was really interesting for me to really be introspective about the fact that, okay, that was my mother's depression. And so I don't know what it looks like without that, but I know I don't have any of those feelings towards the holidays. So how do I want them to look? What do I want them to be like? How do I personally feel about them? And there's a huge difference when you have that control, whether it's in something like that. I mean, when you just realize that, holy cow, wait, I can rewrite this entire thing to make it look any way that I want. Relationships the same way, except that, you know, logic and emotion don't always play well in the sandbox. And so you get into a situation that you seem good. And I always call it when the bills are due. You know, things look real happy until the bills are due. And it's just that point in the relationship where all of a sudden you have to sit down and pay all the bills, and it's not quite so lovey-dovey and fairy tale endings. There's a point in a relationship where it just gets real, and you can't just smile and pretend it's good anymore. Things happen. There are stresses. The bills are due, you know? And in that relationship, when that happens, I think there's a switch, and we all see who the person really is, because we're all doing it. I'm not innocent of this. We're on our best behavior in the very beginning. We are acting like the person that we want to be the most. Mm-hmm. And at some point you get sick, or you have a stress, or you work overtime, or whatever it is. There's an issue with the child. There are things that happen, and the bills are due. And, you know, the true colors come out. And I would like to think that my true colors aren't vastly different. It's not this massive chasm. It's not like looking over the Grand Canyon. But, I mean, I know my best behavior, my worst behavior. There's a difference in who I am and personality. And I think I just chose, and you get to that point, and I remember feeling like, okay, so what now? How do I navigate it? What I realized later in life is that I'm very, very good at deciding it's not healthy and it's not good. And I did a year of therapy. I've had four serious relationships. And the fourth one I'm in now, and I've been in for several years. In the first three, what I realized is that I'll go to therapy, I'll call people out, I will stand up for myself, I do all those things that I would have told myself to do as a younger person. And the first two, we went through therapy for a year. And the third one, we went through therapy for 4 months. And it isn't that I'm not willing to try, but I will hit a point of no return. And walking away is not difficult for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that that is my biggest defense mechanism, that I will do everything that I can in a relationship from my perspective, put everything I can in, do everything the therapist recommends, have open discussions. You know, I have no problem admitting my faults, but I hit a point where when it's not working and it's not working, it's not working, I'm like, I'm done, I'm out. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's a great skill. Not only can I walk away, I can walk away without being like devastated and torn up. The sad thing is that, and I've seen this with any of my friends who have gotten divorced, that relationship may not be functional and working. And maybe you do need to leave that situation. But we turn around and we go immediately or relatively quickly and look for another relationship that we wanted. You know what I mean? It's not like we don't want a relationship at all, so we're walking away. We just want one that's different. And then we go through that same process. I think retrospectively, I could not have made any one of those three relationships work, even if I had dug in harder. I do know that in the relationship I'm in now, when things got really hard, when the bills were due in a big way and things were not going well, he looked at me and he said, well, you know, your pattern is that when it really, really gets hard, you walk away. And I said, well, I have never had anyone who really wanted to stick it out and make it work the way I did. I'm not willing to stick it out, but you still have affairs. I'm not willing to stick it out, but you're still an addict. I'm not willing to, you know, there's certain things that I won't tolerate in my life. And I said, I've never had anyone who felt the same way that I did. Like, I'm willing to stick it out and really work on myself and really work on us. And he said, if I promise you that that is what I want, that that is also my agenda, why don't you just try it differently this time and stick it out? And I thought, oh, okay. I didn't know how to respond to that. So I did. And it was the best thing I ever did. And I think when you have that, I know when you have that, when you're both willing to really be raw and vulnerable and admit where you're wrong and where you have shortcomings and work through them individually and together. I mean, that was years ago, and it keeps getting better. And I'm continuously astonished by that, yeah, it does work. Like, I believed that it worked, but I never saw that it worked. So.
But I agree with you. I think that I have very similar, let's say, traumas, you know, father who was an alcoholic and mother who was doing the single parent concept, but was also addicted very much into the aspect of unhealthy relationships, mm-hmm. sexual abuse. And then I had immigration of coming to another country, kind of like living alone here and moving forward, and the multiple relationships. So I really, really experienced, like, the from every cell of my body hears you and understands you and has experienced similar things that you have. And I do agree with you that there isn't necessarily also this concept of let's just stick it through just because. I think that there's a purpose into a relationship for sticking it through. So just being a martyr at something and, you know, staying in relationships that don't work and feel victimized for the rest of your life and be depressed and miserable, but just because you have to stay and it's not good for you to get a divorce or you can't handle getting a divorce is also not healthy. But there's a purpose into that. And one of the things that I was hearing you say, and I've experienced it myself, is there's a point where I needed to become an adult and also choose an adult versus, you know, be a teenager and keep choosing teenagers, which, you know, their way of being at that moment is a lot of not, you know, feeling responsible for what they do. And it's just more like pleasure oriented versus relational oriented. And sometimes when we grow up to that space where we can actually take ownership of what we do, both to people, and that's where the merge happens. And then there's a reason to stay. There's really a reason to stay.
Oh, yeah. And it's incredible. I mean, I could sit here and bash people I've been in relationships with, except I loved them and chose to be in that relationship with them. And so by putting them down, that's a mirror reflection of myself as far as I'm concerned. I loved them, and there were a lot of reasons that I loved them, and I've tried very hard to make sure that I recall that there are all these reasons, and that I was not physically abused. I was not emotionally, all of the list, that checkoff list that I had from being raised, they weren't checking off those boxes. I was safe. I was secure. It wasn't great. There were arguments, you know, one of the relationships was pretty confrontational, but it wasn't checking off any of those abuse boxes. And in a different situation, these are good people that could have had a really good relationship. And I was half of the problem. I was there too. So I've tried to be really careful about not saying things that are awful about them, especially if there are kids involved, because I chose them. So what does that say about me? Mm-hmm. And I think you know, at some point you grow up enough to realize that, yeah, I'm there too. And although, no, I wasn't the one that had problems with addiction. I wasn't the one having multiple affairs. I wasn't doing those things. I wasn't the one that went to prison. So I've experienced all these things in relationships that I didn't do, but that doesn't make me some saint. And it certainly doesn't make me the martyr. And I don't want to be either one of those, because both are a lie and both are partially true. And I'm sure if you sat them down and had them make the list of all of the things that they thought were terrible about me, they'd have a list equally as long. So I think in relationships, we have to be careful. And I'm not trying to take more of the blame than I deserve, but I'm not willing to negate that that I have none, because that's not true. So I think you grow up and you realize, okay, I don't even know always what my part was in this, what part I played in this not working, but I know I wasn't innocent in that. And so, and again, I wasn't willing to be a martyr. I wasn't willing to live my life in an unhappy way at the expense of myself just to make other things seem better. I wasn't going to have this polite pretend relationship. I was absolutely adamant that I either had a genuine, fulfilling relationship that had problems that we worked through and were human beings who mess up, or I was not. But I'm not willing to sacrifice myself. And so although, you know, in the beginning I said this was my biggest failure, and now I'm showing you I'm proud of what I'm proud that I stood my ground, and I don't think that I did anything wrong in doing that. So my biggest failure is also one of my more proud accomplishments, and that's a contradiction.
Well, I think that the using of the word failure when we leave a relationship that doesn't work, it only pretty much shows up in the relationship world, because I think that there's a connotation behind it that, you know, you need to be married until death do you apart. So I think it's a cultural concept that is given us, because if you hear anyone who says, you know, I stayed in the first job that I ever got at age 18 and didn't get promotion, didn't do anything, and at all, I stayed there for 50 years. We never tell, you know, we never think of that person as, wow, what a successful person. We don't, right? I mean, when it comes to career, when it comes to experiences, when it comes to homes, buying homes, or everything that you can imagine, we see people as success is there is some place which they feel connected and it's great and they're learning. And then when the learning is complete, they go to the next level, to the next level, to the next level. Now, this doesn't mean that people who have long-term relationships, 60 years of marriages, that they didn't go to the next level, but thank God they were able to do it within their relationship. But all relationships don't grow the same way. And if it's not, if you don't have the capacity or you don't have the partner that grows in that way together, then obviously staying in a wrong relationship just for sticking it through, it's also not healthy. So I could see that the word failure shows up for all of us, for everyone, but it's more of a cultural perspective of that if you were in a relationship, you tried to work it, it didn't work out, that if you left, somehow it became your failure. What if it's not? It's actually a success to have an understanding that this wasn't for me, but I learned from it. So you've learned from your relationship and have, you know, finally chosen someone who has the capacity to stick it through and, you know, learn within the relationship for both of you to grow. So I could bring those two together if we just drop off the word failure, because maybe it just doesn't match for you to be there.
I don't think it does match. Same thing with the word regret. I don't think those words, those are the vernacular that I would use. I don't know what the proper one is, but I love that you related it to a job where you leave a job and you don't, like, okay, people high five you, you know, we're in relationships. They don't. Here's another thing though, I want to point out, because you brought up jobs, is that when I apply for a job, you go in and you have an interview, it's called dating. You have an interview, right? And there are expectations. Here's your job description. These are the expectations. This is what I'm going to do. This is what you're going to do. This is how long I think it will take. And then we're going to review it. We may review it at 30 days, at 60, at 90, but we're going to check back in and see how it's going. Now, if I don't hold up my end of the bargain or you don't hold up your end of the bargain, then we can just walk away. It's called getting fired or quitting. The thing about relationships that I think is so sad is that we don't treat them more like that. And I know that that seems really maybe unemotional, but it is the number one biggest relationship that I'm in with this man that I love. We're raising kids. We're together almost 24/7. We're making these enormous decisions that change lives. And yet we don't have a job description. We don't have a list of expectations. We don't check in. And I'm not saying that I don't in my situation now. I think that that's what doesn't work in a lot of relationships is that we go into it wildly. Not that sex is a bad thing, but, you know, it's sex driven in the beginning. It's flowers and romance. It's how great. And then the bills come in. And all of a sudden, we have to have these real raw conversations. But we should have had that conversation in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I learned years and years and years ago, you know, a prenup sounds like this terribly emotionally charged, awful thing, but I think it's kind of like a job description. Most people think the prenup is all about finances, but what if you looked at dating more like you look at a job? Because I'm spending more time with this person than I ever am at a job, and I can walk away from a job much more easily, but we don't really check in, like, what are your goals? Where do you want to be? How do you want this relationship to look? What are your expectations?
And how And how do you have to behave in a way that if you wanted to actually leave the job, that you needed to get a recommendation letter from your from your ex-employee?
I mean, you know, I think if I called, if we called all three of them, they would have things to say that were not favorable, and they would probably give me a pretty decent job recommendation.
Yeah. So and the question is, will she be rehired? Will probably be yes.
Probably yes. Chances look pretty good. I just think we need to treat it like just take a step back and look at how we treat everything else in our lives. Like the contract to buy a car, it's ridiculous. It takes you 5 hours, right? But you date somebody on a whim and you're in a relationship and you, without blinking, you haven't done anything. And I just think it's interesting that we treat relationships so casually when they're so important and we treat other things with such importance that maybe shouldn't have so much weight.
Yeah, and I would actually extend that to what I said you probably created a mastery at it is child rearing, you know, creating children and child rearing. So how did it get to 18? Like how you must have really had a tremendous amount of excitement and fun and joy to keep adding to the numbers.
Well, I think one thing is, you know, have you ever had like a bad haircut? But it's not that the haircut was bad. It's just not the style you ended up thinking you thought it would look good on you. And it just doesn't. But what if it was exactly what you, if you treat it like it's what you wanted and it's exactly what you wanted and you loved it, your attitude's totally different, right?
Yes.
I know that that's like a
you actually choose it. The minute you get to choose it, your attitude is different. Yes.
Right. I chose my life and I really, really loved it. And I think that went a long way. So I had that third grade teacher and I grew up in dysfunction and I actually went through infertility. And after 7 surgeries and getting up to in vitro, I was done. I knew in vitro was not for me. I applaud any woman who wants to go through it. I just knew that it wasn't my path. So I ended up getting pregnant and the doctor at the time said, do you know, it's your miracle. And I checked in with other doctors, three actually, and all three said the same thing, you know, without in vitro, like this was a miracle. You're probably never going to have kids again. But I already knew I wanted to do foster care. I already knew that there were all these kids out there that feel unworthy and unwanted. And someone made a difference to me in passing. Maybe I could make a difference to these kids. So I started doing foster care after my first daughter was born. And I did get pregnant. I got pregnant 7 times total. It's not in the book. It might be sex. I think I'm onto something new, cutting edge, because my infertility specialist is like, you can't get pregnant. I'm like, do you know? I think it's actually sex that causes it. I don't. I'm gonna go out on a limb here. But I got pregnant 7 times total. I gave birth to 4 children. I lost 3. I ended up with a hysterectomy. It was 10 surgeries total for those kids and 7 pregnancies total. It was a lot on my body, and it was totally worth it. But those were the kids I didn't think I would have. So when people say, oh, you chose these foster kids. Well, yeah, I mean, I chose them, but they were a surprise. They weren't a surprise. The kids I biologically gave birth to were the surprise. So I had a kind of different attitude, like, oh, I got pregnant. Let's see what happens with this one. Maybe we'll have a baby out of it. But foster care was really important to me. And I was part of a foster adoption program. I was a foster parent for 9 years with my ex-husband, and then I did it for another 3+ years on my own. So I adopted 5 children. I adopted 4 children with my ex-husband. And then, you know, here I was with, you know, 8 kids at home, and I adopted a 5th, and I took in her 2 siblings also, and that stayed long-term. So I ended up total with 5 kids that I call extras. One of them was a foreign exchange student who has just always been part of the family. The other 4, 3 of them aged out with me in foster care, and one was just long-term in foster care, but is still a teenager, and I still keep tabs on her. So those 5 extras and, you know, the 5 adopted, I was now single because I had gotten divorced. So I had 14, and I stopped doing foster care. I felt like that was kind of done. And I did start, I ran a nonprofit. So there were 2 of us that kind of split the director's position, and we were both program supervisors. And I actually recruited and trained foster parents. So I had extensive training because I had to be at the level to actually train other people. And I worked with treatment level kids, which are the kids that have been through the most. They're the toughest of the tough. And I loved it. And I even really enjoyed teenagers, although some days I disagree with myself on that one because I have a couple of them. But I chose it and I loved it. And I was single. My daughter, who's now just turning 28, she introduced me to the man that I'm with now. She and a friend introduced me, and he had 4 children and his wife had died. So that's the short, compressed story of how we got 18. When he and I met, I had 8 kids living at home. I had 9, and then one moved out right around the time we met. And he had his 4 living at home. And so I think a couple things happened. We had both been through, you know, he had been married twice, and I had been married 3 times. And we had kids, and we had opposite work schedules. There was a lot within the dynamic. I would not recommend this to anyone, but we moved in after 3 months, which is insane. I mean, I think we're insane. We think we're insane. It's interesting that if he were sitting with me and we were telling the story, he would say that I told him I thought he should move in, but I didn't. He told me he was going to move in, and we totally disagree. And I think it was a conversation that he and I had that it's really good. We both thought the other one was saying this because like neither one of us wanted to. I swear it was him and he swears it was me.
Obviously you guys agreed.
I mean, at some point, like I was terrified. I was like, what are we doing? Are we really going to do this? Because it's 12 kids living in the same house. Now, if we hadn't done it that way, we would not have been able to stay together. Just the dynamics of the family and the hours that we worked at our jobs. There were so many things where we lived in town. I knew after a couple of weeks, like I tremendously like you, but this is long term. We can't maintain this relationship. And we did have those conversations, but I am telling you right now, I did not invite him to move in. It was all him, and he will swear the same thing. And I think we've just accepted the fact that it was good. We both thought it was the other person because it wouldn't have happened. And we both had some unhealthy relationships. He emancipated at 15, and his parents had some trauma. He had a great childhood, but when he hit about 15, things went a little sideways. And so there was trauma in his childhood woven into that. And, you know, he didn't have successful, in quotations, relationships. He had had some struggles with that and experienced addiction and some of the same infidelity, some of the same things that I had. So I think we came into it with the same desire to have the same type of relationship and the same ethic to work for it. And we blended those families and it was absolutely crazy. And now I have to say, now that most of our kids are adults now, and so we have 4 kids, well, 5. 5 live in one house together and 2 live in another house together. And so, and 2 are in long-term relationships. And so, you know, married in San Antonio, but the kids that are not married yet or not in long-term relationships, they rent houses and share that responsibility together. So it was interesting to me that they blended really, really well. His oldest 3 were the same age as all of my kids. And they all came from a big family and knew they wanted to get out of the house right away. And we fostered really independent kids. We wanted them to be really independent, but I think that they were sharing rooms and we were such a tight knit family that they really wanted their own space also. So they moved out to all share with each other, which is amusing to me, but you know, they can, like you said, you get to make the rules now, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want them living in my house long-term. So it's all good. So that's how the 18 came. So 10.
It's amazing. Yeah, 10, I used to work with, well, you're not in LA, but LA has the Bienvenidos foster care. And I used to work and train actually foster parents for many, many years. And it is very rewarding. It's tough, but it's very, very rewarding. So I could see where, you know, and a lot of the parents, the same thing they used after foster care, they adopted the children. And it's just, you know, you create a bond and it's beautiful. And for some reason, if the biological parents are not there, one of the, I know we only have like two more minutes, but the sentence that in your book is triumph with love. And you could really, really experience that when, you know, talking to you in, you know, people who go through a lot, they have an option of being bitter and resentful and a victim for the rest of their life. And you have an option of not, you know, shifting and triumphing with love and giving love and, you know, learning what you can learn and offer what you've learned and share it to the world and, you know, exchange the best of you. Like you said, we all have our worst and best, and exchange the best of you with the best of the world, you know, has offered. And I sincerely see that that's what you have created for yourself. And you bring that out with your book, and you bring that out with not only like your family, you know, creating such a huge and beautiful family systems that, you know, all of that can go on and create more family systems. Everybody coming from actually broken families, except the ones, you know, and even the ones you had was also went through the divorce with you. So it is sweet to see that all of these broken families ultimately are creating and choosing their own family systems and bringing that out, all out. And also with your podcast and sharing, and then also your blogs, sharing all of the ups and downs of the world that you've gone through. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have gone through to them. So thank you for doing that. We have very, like, maybe even like 40 seconds for you to give us the last sentence of what we haven't said. And you really, really want everyone to hear you.
Is it my giveaway?
Yes.
Anybody who emails me gets a free copy of the book.
Yay!
Yay. So I want word to get out there. I think sharing love and giving love and just perpetuating that is where it will all begin.
Say your email and where they can contact you.
Jen, J-E-N-N, at momof18.com.
Say it again.
J-E-N-N, at momof18.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time and, you know, sharing yourself with our audience and listeners and viewers. And for everyone who's out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, take care of yourself. Bye-bye.